Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, you know the drill. We are recording on Tuesday morning, and literally seconds before we go on the air to record, this comes down. The unanimous ruling is a sweeping win for Jack Smith and prosecutors. Here is a quote from the ruling from the D.C. court. Any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against his prosecution. And I'm just going to pull a little nugget from this three-judge panel that voted unanimously, everyone unanimously in D.C. It begins this way. Since then, hundreds of people who breached the Capitol on January 6th have been prosecuted and imprisoned. And as of August 2023 in Washington, D.C., former President Trump was charged in a four-count indictment as a result of his actions challenging the election results and interfering with the sequence set forth in the Constitution for the transfer of power from one president to the next. Former President Trump moved to dismiss the indictment and the district court denied his motion. Today, we affirm the denial. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump, yippee, with all of the defenses of any other criminal defendant. But any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. I want to start singing amen, you know, from the movie. But of course, this can then go to an en banc, which means all the judges in that circuit could decide, or could go directly to the Supreme Court. We will not know. Obviously, the whole thing is mañana, 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 and delay, delay, delay. And of course, that is Donald Trump's friend. So before I introduce my first guest, what I actually wanted to start with was a story about my daughter. And I want to sort of share this story because it's a story about teaching. It's a story about an urban environment versus a rural environment. And I think it's a good story. So it'll take me 2 seconds and then I will introduce Marsha. My daughter left Shanghai at the end of the COVID lockdown in 2022. The population of Shanghai is 29,868,000. 29 million. Can you believe that? It is the second largest city in China and the seventh largest city in the world. Where does she land? She lands in rural Vermont and is currently teaching at a teeny tiny elementary school in the middle of the woods, where the outdoors is as much of a classroom as any room in the small school structure. Therefore, over the weekend, she realized that to be a good teacher meant that she not only needed to encourage curiosity, but keep her kids safe. So she spent nearly 16 hours this weekend and walked away with this, a wilderness first aid certification from the world leader in wilderness medicine education. I keep replaying Krista McAuliffe's famous line, I touch the future, I teach. Value teachers, support them. The war in public education is a war on the future, and it imperils achievement, a return to segregation, and a diversion of public funds to religious and private schools with little to no oversight. That's what got me thinking about my daughter, the public school teacher. And of course, I'm also the daughter of two public school teachers. So there you go. All right. Joining us right now, and she's joined us on a number of occasions, is Marsha Brown. She is the food and agriculture reporter for Politico. And she wrote this piece and I'm like, huh? And here's the title, Seeing Viral Pork TikToks. I don't go on TikTok, but maybe I need to start. It's a government-backed group pushing meat on Gen Z. Ad campaigns from controversial quasi-government programs for pork, dairy, and beef are raising new questions around the Chekhov program's foray into social media. And with that, let me welcome her to the program. And I'm like, well, first of all, I don't watch TikTok. So that tells you I'm not Gen Z, but they obviously obsessed about TikTok. And it is a great influencer. There is no question about it. And what I think is so fascinating about this push to use these influencers to influence Gen Z is that we're beginning to realize that maybe it's not such a good idea to eat all that beef. Maybe it's not such a good idea to eat all that pork. Maybe we're realizing the consequences for the climate on top of everything else, on top of health, on top of health. It's an environmental story. It's a healthcare story. It's a profit story. And I'm like, well, how the heck does this connect to the government? And then I read your piece. So with that, let me welcome you to the program, Marsha, and tell me a little bit about this government-backed group pushing meat on Gen Z. I had absolutely no clue, but I could have called you or Cory Booker. I mean, I had my choice, and I decided I'd rather call you. So welcome back to the program, and tell me a little bit about this group, how it exists, what is its purpose? And why are we using this checkoff box to do something that in the long run, let them decide on their own, let them be curious, let them do their own research. But you and I both know that in the end, this is not about their health. This is not about the environment. This is about the profit for the pork industry and the profit for the dairy industry and the beef industry. So welcome back to the program. Inform me about something I had absolutely no clue to.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Arnie. It's always great to be here. Yes, so this is a program that if you're in food world, everyone knows about this. This is old news. If you're not, you've never heard of it. Okay. And this is a fun story to do. And essentially, if you've heard of Got Milk, if you've heard of things like pork, the other white meat, beef, yes. it's what's for dinner. These are all, advertising campaigns paid for by these checkoff programs, which started in the 1990s. There's 22 of them for things like popcorn and beef and Christmas trees. The biggest ones are dairy, pork, and beef, and they have multi-million-dollar budgets. If you are a farmer, you are required to pay into them. These are congressionally authorized programs. And if you're a cattle farmer, you pay $1 a head. And then that money goes to advertising and research on beef, things like nutrition or even sustainability. And so a lot of this money is now being used to pay for social media advertising. I mean, in some ways, this is an advertising story. This is like, instead of doing billboards and magazine ads and TV commercials, they're working with influencers on TikTok and Instagram. And so we just started seeing these like pop up on our social media feeds. And my colleague Haley Fuchs and I wrote this story and dug into kind of like why they are pursuing this new generation, you know, what the thinking is behind the advertising campaigns. And the answer was that they recognize that, you know, we have a new generation that thinks about what they eat differently. Like they want to know about the climate change impacts. They want to know about the nutrition facts. And they also maybe use meat differently. Maybe it's not a main dish. Maybe it's a flavoring or a something else.
I will tell you right now, I use pork and beef as what? As a condiment.
Mm-hmm.
As a condiment. Okay. There you go, honey bun. But the reason why this story is also perfect and also timely is that we're waiting for the bill, the farm bill, to be renewed. And the farm bill only comes up every 5 years. So I see I'm getting into this. And so I read that both Senators Booker and Lee are really worried about this checkoff system. And they're worried about it, not that they don't want to like support pork and support dairy and support beef, but they think it lacks transparency and oversight. Well, blow me away with a feather. Tell me about how these programs currently operate and why are Senators Cory Booker and Lee trying to do this? I think they have a bad chance in hell of making it happen just because the amount of money that goes into the final version of the farm bill by the lobbying organizations of Big Ag are going to be overwhelming. And this doesn't seem to rise to the top of what what the farm bill will do, although in the end, the consequences of not addressing this have real health and environmental consequences. So even though we may roll our eyes at this, it really is something that we need to pay attention to. And we probably want to support what Booker and Lee are doing, although I'm not sure our influence will be as great as Cargill's.
So yes, the unlikely duo of Cory Booker and Mike Lee, they have in the past also pushed for more transparency and accountability for these programs. Their proposal would require audits and prevent certain conflicts of interest. The sort of big ag type trade groups, so for example, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, they have very vocally opposed the Lee Booker bill, saying that it would totally do away with the checkoff, which proponents of the bill say it would not. It just adds more transparency and accountability. But like you said, you know, there's a lot that goes into the farm bill. There's a lot of things people are trying to include in the farm bill. We've had an extension, so now it expires this September instead of last September. I don't know that their bill has a very optimistic future. But I do think they are rallying more supporters than they have in the past. Certainly, I think the critiques around the use of social media, not just from checkoffs, but other food advertising, private industry advertising, has also kind of lent itself to a larger conversation about this.
So one of the things the checkoff isn't only about advertising. So one of the things I'm reading about in your article is, oh, but look, this gives us research money. we get to sort of not only talk about like the dairy and the pork and the beef, but we're going to do research to explain to you why it's so good for you to be drinking chocolate milk, or why it's going to be so good for you to, you know, eat more of the other white meat, whatever that is. And of course, in your article, you have a professor who says industry-funded research almost invariably comes out with results that favor the sponsor's interest. Oh, blow me away. So that means it's conflicted research. You think? And I think, again, part of the reason why I love your article is not only did I have no clue about the checkoff, I didn't realize about what they were doing on TikTok. So tell me about this money. So this money, is this money only for the purposes of this research and this marketing? And who does the oversight right now of how this money is used? Like, who are the people that currently, there must be some kind of oversight, there must be some kind of transparency. So connect the dots for me, because I want to know how the money is dispersed and who approves or disapproves.
So I'll start with advertising. So USDA, the Agriculture Marketing Service, AMS, they oversee the advertising that the checkoffs produce. And they actually, the checkoff actually has to get their ads approved by AMS. And so they will submit, in social media, it's slightly different. They will submit kind of a content strategy, because social media is published kind of in real time. And I actually spoke to someone who said that they have had instances where they've had to ask influencers to take down certain posts because they didn't comply with what USDA had approved. And so we've seen a little bit of that. And so the other thing about this is there are all these checkoffs are overseen by boards, and the members of those boards are appointed by the Secretary of Agriculture. So this is how Congress authorized the programs and designed the programs. So there is a lot of USDA involvement in these programs, but they are very professional. So a lot of the folks that are running the advertising portfolio of, you know, dairy, for example, they came from places like PepsiCo and, like, you know, really major food companies. And so they're very professional. They're very good at what they do.
And how many consumers and how many professors and how many, like, people who actually do the science are on these boards? I mean, you're telling me about companies. No, I'm like, no surprise there. I just want to know what the complexity is. And I'm not exactly excited about the head of, who is it? The guy from Iowa. Isn't he the governor from Iowa? Isn't he the guy who's in charge? Yeah. Vilsack. I can't stand him. Anyway, because Vilsack always feels like he's a pawn of the industry. He was a pawn of the industry when he was in Iowa. So then we move him up the food chain. Now he's now a bigger pawn because he's like in charge of everything. So as I'm hearing all this, I'm a little bit nervous. Is there any requirement that these boards have diversity on the boards? So there are consumers on the boards. There are scientists on the board. There's the industry on the board. At least if I knew there was some complexity here, I would feel less hysterical. But I don't know if there's actually any kind of requirement about the makeup of these boards.
I don't actually know the answer if there's any kind of requirement for the boards, but I do think they tend to be, you know, folks in the industry, folks who are interested in, you know, promoting beef consumption, promoting dairy consumption. And, you know, proponents of the programs point to the fact that they say, you know, oh, they're really effective. These are farmers who, you know, they couldn't necessarily pay for advertising on their own, but they're pooling their resources. And this way they can, you know, promote a consumption of whole foods, kind of. You know, I think that's an interesting argument in sort of the larger worldview of, like, promoting, like, other types of food that maybe isn't as healthy for you. And I mean, I think one of the things that when we talk to folks about this that I thought was interesting is, you know, a lot of these ads make nutrition claims, for example. And yeah, it's not necessarily that those nutrition claims are not true. It's that other foods might also have the same nutrition. So it's sort of a relative to what question. And you have to think about that, you know, as a consumer all the time when you see ads. So, you know, chocolate milk might be a really good recovery drink, but so might something else. And so it's relative to what? So I think that's kind of an interesting layer to this as well.
All right. So let me pull another paragraph out of your wonderful piece at Politico. We're talking with Marsha Brown, who covers agriculture for Politico. USDA said that it follows the guidelines for the programs as directed by Congress to maintain and expand the markets for the product. That includes social media content, which the Agricultural Marketing Service reviews as part of a larger social media plan. But here's the sentence I love. But USDA staff who oversee the program are, sit down everyone, paid to check. check off fees, not USDA's general funding. Well, shock of shocks. I mean, this is like ripe with conflict. I mean, just like, how do you breathe in there? I just want to know. And that's why, as I'm reading this, I mean, I understand. I mean, I got to really like Cory Booker when he ran for president for 16 seconds. So I got to hang out with him. And I can see why he's really ticked off. You know, I mean, this is such a joke. And as you point out here, a lot of small farmers are going, really, what's our benefit? I mean, they see the benefit for the big, you know, corporate agriculture, but I'm not sure that that actual benefit trickles down for them. And as you said, they're paying, what, a dollar per head? I'm trying to figure out, do they get 2 cents back for that dollar per head? And then you begin to realize that the staff who oversees the program are paid for by this damn checkoff box. So they don't want to see the program shrink. They want to see it expand. You know, it's their check. So in every way, shape, or form, it does sort of lack a sense of accountability and transparency. And people want to know why they're disgusted with government. And frankly, the person I want to talk to about this is Vilsack. I want to sit down with Vilsack and say, what do you think is your responsibility, Vilsack? Like, who do you appoint and why do you appoint them? And then you pointed out in your piece that they did find some influencers who went to the extreme. Okay, that's what you said. They said that there were times that they had to pull them back. Really? How many? And how extreme did they have to get? I mean, that's the problem. They can always say, oh, but we have. But when you realize how many TikTok ads there are, Marsha, what, 7 they pulled back? And what did they say? That they could like regrow your hair and give you bigger boobs? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, like, well, how far did they have to go off the reservation in order for them to finally pull them off? And that's part of the problem too, is that in a way their answers are obtuse. And that's what I think is so frightening about this. And I am worried about people's health. And I'm worried about agriculture. I want people to be healthy and I want agriculture to be both diverse and survive. And one of the things that we've been hearing about, for example, is the cost of food has gone through the roof. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, well, maybe you're being talked into buying stuff that costs too much or maybe in the long run isn't even healthy for you. So it's about these kinds of informed decisions that scare me.
Yeah, anyway. I think that, you know, the criticism from farmers of these programs really centers on how effective they are. And one thing, you know, we look at in this piece is the consumption of fluid milk. So just drinking milk. Got Milk promoted that. You know, they had celebrities with the milk mustaches. And the entire time that campaign was running, which is considered the most successful checkoff ad campaign, fluid milk consumption was declining. Now, on the other hand, Americans are eating a lot more cheese. So it's not like dairy consumption overall is cratering in the same way. And actually, one kind of fun fact is that the checkoff has worked with companies like Taco Bell to create a very cheesy menu item. So stuff like that, you know, helps bolster consumption of things like cheese. And then, you know, the other point I just wanted to make to kind of your what you were saying about social media and whether these influencers are pulling stuff off of social media. I mean, the thing about social media is there's a lot of organic interaction, right? So it's not just the paid ads. One thing that the checkoffs brought up to me is that, you know, they have a foothold in this marathon women runners community. And so now you have a lot of women who are posting as part of Team Milk, who are not necessarily being paid by Team Milk, but they have found this a supportive community. And that kind of helps to, you know, bolster consumption of milk and kind of push their messaging. And if they're not paying them, I think they probably also have a lot less control over what's happening on social media. And that's also, and in general, that's a challenge with social media. Like, it's not a static billboard ad. You just have,
well, that's its added value. Its added value is that they don't really care as much about what the influencers are saying. Is they care about the response to those influencers, because that expands their footprint and expands their credibility. I mean, an influencer with no response is not going to be an influencer, but an influencer with 1,000 hits is someone who's obviously making the connection. I'm going to talk about milk. So Got Milk, I remember. And so I just went to the doctor for the first time in 12 years. I'm 70. I'm a terrible person. But I decided I had to go to the doctor because I needed to like survive for my granddaughter. So one of the first things they did was they did a bone density scan. Uh-oh, guess what? Thin bones. Uh-oh. On the edge of osteoporosis. First conversation with my doctor. Well, how you doing with milk? Not so good. What about calcium and vitamin D? Oh, I don't take it. So the conversation has been very interesting. So as I'm listening to this, there is some reason to be drinking milk. And I think, as you were saying, the consumption of milk has gone down, but it's not just the consumption of cheese that's gone up. My question is, where has it gone down to? And has it gone down to sodas? Has it gone down to sodas with no sugar? Oh no, soda with aspartame. Okay, so you begin to start asking the question, you want people to actually consume milk. It is a good thing for them. And I don't know if you can eat enough cheese to make up for the milk that you should be drinking. But then the real question I have is, why is the consumption of milk going down? And it's probably not going down as much because of cheese, but it's going down because we're now looking at sugary drinks or fruity drinks that aren't even fruit, but more sugar. And I think that's where there is value. But my question is, again, why would you be afraid of transparency and accountability?
Yeah, I think certainly a lot of people, you know, say that these programs could do good things, but they have a lot of questions about accountability. They have a lot of questions about the role of government. When I've spoken to people about this story, someone brought up MyPlate and the nutrition pyramid. And, you know, they said, well, you know, how does that work with these other nutrition messages from the government? And I think that can be confusing because maybe people think that the checkoff is telling people this is what you should be eating according to all these nutritionists we've consulted, but the checkoff is not really about promoting a certain type of eating. It's about just general consumption. Even though they will say that all of their ads do comply with the dietary guidelines for Americans. So, I mean, it's an interesting conversation. I think it certainly raises a lot of questions. These are long-running critiques, I will say.
Okay, so before I let you go, I only have a couple minutes left. Yeah. So we're talking with Marsha Brown, who wrote this fabulous piece of Politico. So here's my question. So they're using these government-backed groups are pushing meat on Gen Z, and they're using TikTok, and they're using influencers. Is there any requirement that the influencer informs the TikTok audience who's paying the bill? Who's asking that influencer to, in fact, inform them? Like, the Dairy Council just called me and asked me to talk about milk. So I'm going to tell you about why I drink chocolate milk. I mean, is there any way that you can at least have that kind of transparency that I'm not just doing this because I love chocolate milk, but I bet you there's a check with a comma in it. And I just want to know if there's any kind of requirement that information is part of what they're going to be seeing on TikTok, because I kind of like to know.
Yes, so there is. So it has to say something like, you know, dairy goes by undeniably dairy and gonna need milk. And so it'll say something like paid, sponsored, or ad. And the checkoff, as far as I could tell, was largely following the requirements. I mean, this is something that has come up, though, with private industry ads. There was a big Washington Post article about aspartame. And apparently the American Beverage Association was paying all of these nutritionists to say things about aspartame. That's one of the issues with social media. And frankly, if you're, you know, if you're looking at something and it says paid for by undeniably dairy, do you really know?
Like, undeniably dairy? How do I know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you might think, oh, yeah, this is like a dairy industry group, but you might not kind of click through and find out, oh, this is like a government, quasi-government program. So there's that added layer of complication, I think.
I want people to make good decisions. I want them to have a range of information. I want to be able to trust the research that's being done. But I go back to the aspartame story. And at some point, you need to go back. Have you ever looked at the origins of aspartame? Let me give you a name that's connected with aspartame. I actually did a lot during the early like 1990s. All I'm going to give you is the name of the head of Searle, who is in part responsible for aspartame. You know who it was? Donald Rumsfeld. So as soon as you hear Rumsfeld and aspartame, start shaking like a leaf. I'm just telling you, because the story of the origins of aspartame and how it got in the market and how it got approved, even though scientists were saying don't approve it. Okay, I just want to let you know. So now fast forward, it's 2024, and we're talking about like in the 1960s or 1970s that they were approving aspartame. But I just think in so many ways, that's why you want transparency, and that's why you want accountability, and that's why we want Marsha Brown to share her stories from Politico. So thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It sounds like I have a little homework.
Oh, you got to read the story of aspartame. It'll blow your mind. All right, everyone. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. It is clear that the war in Gaza is politically damaging for Joe Biden. Arab American voters, who on their own don't make up enough in any particular state, even Michigan, to change the outcome of the election, but combined with voters on the left who are upset about the civilian casualties in Gaza and upset about how Biden has offered unequivocal support to Israel, can cause enough political damage to Biden for him to lose a few key states, like, for example, Michigan. Similarly, Biden has picked up almost no votes because of his support for Israel. Many voters who are also supportive of Israel were probably supporting Biden to begin with, and those ultra hawks who think that Biden isn't doing enough for Israel were basically never going to be with Biden. On the other hand, while the war dragging on hurts Biden and is not good for Israel, obviously isn't good for the people of Gaza, and for what it's worth, is not good for the Jews, it is good for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The longer the war drags on, the longer he can stay in office, because the day after this war ends, he very likely will have to stand in front of the Israeli electorate. And as soon as that election happens, he's out of office. And as soon as he's out of office, he very likely is on his way back to jail or at least to trial. So Netanyahu has an incentive to keep this war going on. Biden has an incentive to make this wrap up soon somehow. Biden is the more powerful in this relationship. United States is the patron. Israel is basically the client. It is time, it has long been time, for Biden to craft a better policy on this war. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Swamps, marshes, and other wetland wonderlands. On this current cast. People once considered wetlands useless as little more than soggy ground waiting to be drained and put to better use. Now we recognize wetlands as valuable. Besides being quiet places of safety and serene seclusion for innumerable animal, bird, and plant species, wetlands function for people in amazing ways. They trap and hold raging floodwaters, replenish both groundwater and downstream water bodies, slow soil erosion, and filter out pesky pollutants. Development projects have devoured millions of acres of wetlands over the past 100 years, so it's important that we preserve and protect the wetlands that remain. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people, this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
If I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, we continue to record on Tuesday morning. I'm looking at an article that's entitled Taking Media Out of the Market. And I'm like, oh boy, do I get this. We have a lot of these sort of nonprofits cropping up because we've seen the loss of media between consolidation, between the thin advertising stream. The Concord Monitor is now like 2 pages long. The union leader is half of what it used to be. A number of the local papers in my state basically don't exist. And I've seen the rise of these little nonprofits like VT Digger, like In-Depth New Hampshire, and they're living on a shoestring, but they believe in journalism. Somehow, I'm not sure how they're going to continue to survive because the monetizing opportunities have become more and more challenging. So as I'm reading Taking Media Out of the Market, I realized I needed to reach out to the person who wrote the piece. Professor Victor Picard is the Edwin Baker Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. And I want to welcome him to the program. Thank you so much, Victor, for doing this.
Thank you, Arnie, for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. Not only do I fret and worry about what I see, because as someone who basically believes that put out information. Yeah, I have an opinion, but more than I have an opinion, I want to make sure I start with the information and then I can tell you what I think, but I want you first to be informed. And I have lived a lot of what your story is about, you know, about what has happened to the media. I used to write for the Boston Globe. I was paid $750 a column, okay, to write for the Boston Globe. This is in 1997. I wrote for the Globe for what they called the New Hampshire Weekly. And then all of a sudden, the Boston Globe got bought by the New York Times. Remember that? And the New York Times bought the Globe. And then guess what? Au revoir, Arnie. There went the New Hampshire Weekly. We didn't need that anymore, but yet we did need it. Okay, we did need it. And then I was doing a talk TV show, and the talk TV show was an informational show. It was, you know, we brought in policy people and whatever. I got hired, and at my 6-month anniversary, I was brought in, and they were going to triple my salary, because they were just starting me out. I was developing an audience. But here's what the requirement was that I could stay on hosting this show, but I needed to understand that I would have no oversight over content. And I looked at them and I said, what? And I said, that's a deal breaker. He said, I told them. He thought that maybe the money would make the difference. And I said, no, that wouldn't make the difference. And I quit. So you can just imagine getting blacklisted. And then my last story before I let you sort of wax poetic about what we both know is such a challenge going into the future and is the essence of what we need to do to protect democracy. I am on a commercial radio station and I am on from, I think, 12 to 3. I talk about, you know, the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the car industry, all the things that a good consumer advocate would be talking about. Why? What about this drug? Why would you want to buy that car? That kind of thing. And I would bring people information. So guess what happened? It's not that my audience didn't like me. It was the advertisers that didn't like me. And the advertisers went to the owners of the station and they said, get her off. Okay. So the morning I get pink slipped is also the day of the New Hampshire Association of Broadcasters award ceremony. And my husband says to me, you've got to go. And I'm like, got to go? Why would I go? And he said, you've got to go. I said, I just got fired this morning. I don't want to show up there. Everyone will know. He said, you have to go. So he drags me to this award ceremony. I'm sitting literally almost against the wall. Everyone in the room knew what happened. Okay, it's a state, New Hampshire, you know, the size of a suburb. And so we're in the room and they announce the radio talk host of the year. And who got it but me?
Wow.
Okay. The morning I get fired, I mean, it was a different title, but it was I can't remember, I'm having a mind for it. Anyway, but I got the plaque. Anyway, so, and the guy who's giving me the award is shaking because he knows what had happened, okay? And everyone is applauding, but they're also being sent a message. It wasn't Arnie's talent. It wasn't her ability to connect with an audience. It was about money and profit. And therefore, to disclose information that might actually make people think about what it was they were buying and making an informed decision, you were not then appropriate to be on the radio. And that was commercial radio. That was my last gig on commercial radio. So as I'm reading your piece, I've lived it, but you and I both know, Victor, it's much worse today. So let's talk about where we are and what that means, and the nature of the lack of information, the lack of journalism, what are the models that still sort of continue to exist? But how do we in the future get the information we need? Because in a democracy, unless you're in a cult with Trump, you really need to have information so that when you go into the voting booth, whether it's for town clerk or whether it's for president, you have questions asked and questions answered. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. We're off to a very, you know, bleak start, but that's the way it should be as we talk about what's happening to our news media today. And as you said, you've lived through this. You're well aware that these are long-term downward trends, and it's only getting worse. So I think as a society, we really need to reckon with that reality and start thinking about how do we create a news media system, a system that we need that serves democracy, that's not dependent on the market. Because everything you just told us is just further proof that if we peg our news media so closely to the market, to these capitalist imperatives, these profit imperatives, then we're not going to have the news that we need. There's going to be this kind of market censorship that you were just talking about. Yeah. That, you know, oftentimes good journalism is bad business. And, you know, we have to separate the two. And as you also noted, we're living through this kind of, I dare say, a golden age of nonprofit experimentation. Like, we're seeing so many great new newsrooms sprout up, but too often they're you know, existing on a shoestring. It's not creating enough jobs. It's not a systemic fix. So we really need to think bigger and more ambitiously about how we as a democratic society can support the media that we need so that people can make a livelihood, so that they're not starving journalists. And that's really what we should be talking about.
Well, you also mentioned, so we know that there's been consolidation. We know about the commercialization, about the fact that the advertisers now are basically, you know, sort of dictating what in fact should be coming out of the newsroom. But then you have something I think is really important, which is that the oligarchs, the benevolent billionaires who are going to come in and they're going to save the media. And of course, you give the example of Bezos. You give the example of, I don't know who Sun Xiang is, but you give these examples of these billionaires who've come in and bought up these papers. And you said, well, how successful is that as a model? And of course, if they're billionaires, they're also marketers. They're also people who want to make money. And they may want to come scoop in and they think, oh, anyone can make money. I'll make money at the Washington Post as Jeff Bezos. And then all of a sudden he's hemorrhaging. And then what the first thing he does is he doesn't like say, well, so what? I don't need that much of a profit. He starts cutting the newsroom. He starts cutting the editorial room. So the billionaires aren't the savers of these institutions. Not only that, they may even destroy the institution they buy because they have an agenda here, and their billionaire agenda isn't necessarily to save the paper, but to put out their misinformation or their doctored information, especially when it comes to the guy that's affiliated with Sinclair. We've been covering Sinclair News for a long time, and then to see what he's done with the Baltimore Sun, is it, I believe, in Maryland,
that's right,
is shocking. So let my audience know a little bit about the connections, about what these billionaires, who they are, what they've bought, and why you have historically gone to these papers because they were so well known for their brilliant journalism, and why you need to begin to fear that because of who bought them and what their expectation is.
That's right. These are all very legitimate concerns, and the so-called benevolent billionaire model for saving journalism, but first it begs the obvious observation that not all billionaires are benevolent. As you suggest, they often come in with a particular agenda. Even those who aren't immediately trying to make money are probably doing it for other reasons, even, you know, maybe somewhat benign reasons. They just think it will look good. It's good for their reputation, or it might come in handy at some point down the road. But then we see that even these billionaires are suffering sticker shock when they're losing tens of millions of dollars a year. Maybe they don't care that much about news, after all, about serving the public interest. So we're seeing them cut just hundreds of jobs. We just, in the last couple of weeks, we saw the LA Times cut 115 jobs, over 20% of their newsroom. Washington Post back in December cut or bought out 240 positions, about 10% of their employees. So these were meant to be the survivors, right? The main newspapers that were still somehow surviving through the wreckage of the last, you know, 20 years. And we should remind our listeners that, again, this is part of a long-term trend going back to 2005, and not as if 2005 was some sort of you know, glory days for the newspaper industry. But since then, we've lost nearly two-thirds of our newspaper employees and one-third of our newspapers. This is shocking. This should be seen as a national crisis. And you don't have to have nostalgia for, you know, ink-stained fingers and wrestling through broadsheets to know that even in their beleaguered state, it is the newspapers that still provide most original news and information that feeds throughout our entire news media ecosystem. So regardless of whether you're getting your information from Facebook or TikTok or wherever, it's oftentimes deriving back to these old-fashioned and increasingly suffering newspapers. So that's why they're the ones that are doing local journalism, and that's what's disappearing. That's why we should be so concerned.
I love ProPublica, okay? And I go to ProPublica a lot. I actually go to theconversation.com a lot as well, okay? But the problem with ProPublica and theconversation.com and some of the other papers is that they're not as committed to what's happening in Asheville or Concord or, I mean, your local. I mean, you need someone that's going to care about your community, because in a way, the rot begins there. I mean, let's be honest. And we're also seeing that that's where the takeover is happening. Look at Moms for Liberty. You know, where did they come from? God knows where, some like Republican arm of Florida. And then they create this sort of faux grassroots organization. And then all of a sudden they're taking over school boards. Well, they can take over a school board because who covers school boards anymore? There is no journalism to cover school boards. All of a sudden, when you realize what they're doing, they've already done so much damage that now you're in the middle of a fight and you have to replace them. And then you have to sort of fill the holes that they've created. But if there had been some local journalism, there would be. So your suggestion about ProPublica, and again, I want to remind everyone about ProPublica, because it's a lot of ways that they sort of expose what happened with the Supreme Court. I mean, we know now more about a guy named Harlan Crow than we could ever possibly want to imagine, but we didn't know about these guys until ProPublica spent the time to tell us about the Supreme Court. But that's at the top of the food chain. You know, what's happening at the bottom of the food chain ultimately is in some ways not more important, but it directly impacts your daily life. So Victor, do other countries do this? Like, are we so committed to this commercial marketing for-profit model that once again, just like we do our damn healthcare system, just the way we do everything, everything is with a ka-ching and a comma. I just want to know what other countries are doing, not that they're nirvana, but do they have a more flourishing media landscape than we do? And if they do, what do they do?
That's a great question. And of course, a lot of nuances in particular is around the globe, but to really try to summarize it, I mean, many countries around the world that have commercial media systems are suffering similar problems. We're talking about news deserts here in the United States, where tens of millions of Americans live in areas that have access to little or no local media whatsoever. This is increasingly becoming a problem in other countries as well. However, what they have that we don't have in the US is a strong public broadcasting system, much, much bigger than NPR or PBS, whatever we have here. And I'm not just talking about the BBC, which many Americans know about, but in most democratic countries around the world, they subsidize a public media system that can kind of serve as a social safety net, although oftentimes they're also not covering the local journalism that those societies need. But just to give a sense, like, the US is literally off the chart for how little we allocate towards our public broadcasting every year. Per person, it comes out to about $1.40. Compare that to the Brits, they're paying about $100 per year for the BBC. In Western, Northern European countries, they're spending far more than that. And it shows their democracies, according to the Economist's Democracy Index, an annual report they put out. And of course, they're not raging left-wingers. They're very mainstream analysts. But they now categorize, for many years now, the U.S. has been categorized as a flawed democracy. But whereas many of the strongest democracies on the planet also happen to have very strong, robust public broadcasting systems. So that's one thing that most democratic countries are doing differently than us. Many countries are also subsidizing their newspaper industry in various ways. It's something that we're slowly talking about here in the States. But as you suggest, we're just so overly commercialized here in the US. We're wedded to this market fundamentalism, and that's a huge part of the problem.
When I think of sort of government underpinning of information, I think of Canada, okay? And I think of the CBC. But actually what I also think about is, guess who's appeared a lot on TVO, TV Ontario, Arnie Arneson. Not only do they have the Canadian broadcasting system, but the different provinces actually have their own. So again, what they're constantly doing is they're slicing the pie. So they want to tell a Canadian story, but then they want to tell a province story. And then they want to tell a Toronto story. And then they want to tell a Montreal story. And so again, they also understand that there is a commitment from the government, but there has to be different layers of commitment. And that is what I think is so fabulous. You know, I mean, there's nothing like that for us in the United States. And you talk about subsidies. What do you mean by subsidies? What kind of subsidies? Who would do the oversight on subsidies? I want you to read the article. I'm going to send you the article. We just did this thing about checkoffs and TikTok and with a woman from Politico about how we sort of are subsidizing, you know, the agricultural industry to sell their beef and sell their pork and sell their dairy. And there's very little transparency and very little accountability. So I'm like, well, we know how to subsidize something. I'm not sure we get what we want for the subsidies, but at least we're subsidizing them. So when you're talking about looking at subsidies for media, I don't want to subsidize Fox. I'll be honest with you. I don't want to subsidize Sinclair. But how do I make a decision about what do we mean by subsidizing, and then who gets the cash?
Right. Those are key questions that as a society, we really need to wrestle with, especially since we know the market is not going to support the level of journalism that we need. So we've got to find non-market means of support. And as we've been discussing, we might be seeing nonprofits expand, that sector's expanding, but that's still based on private capital. A lot of that's still coming from the so-called benevolent billionaires and the big foundations. And we can't trust, I mean, they might put out some fantastic journalism, but that again is not a systemic fix. So we've got to find a way to subsidize. And first, the first thing we should remember is that media subsidies are as American as apple pie, going back to the postal system, which when it was first founded, it was essentially a newspaper delivery infrastructure. 80-some percent of its weight was made up of newspapers well into the 1800s. So wow. What the founders decided to do, they didn't think the market was going to support this to make sure that information is being disseminated all over the place. They realized they had to subsidize that so that newspapers were basically heavily subsidized to the tune of what would be equivalent to billions of dollars today, subsidizing the delivery of newspapers to far-flung communities across the country. So if we remember that tradition, and as you suggested, we subsidize industries left and right, usually not stuff like, you know, around things that we really, really need, like information. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we need to be discussing. And we can do things like decide that only institutions that are actually producing journalism. So that would cut out Fox. That would cut out Sinclair. That would cut out.
If you lie 12 times in a matter of 15 minutes, maybe you're not exactly the journalist. I mean, I remember doing exactly. Fox News once. You're going to love this, Victor. I'm on Fox News and it's like 3-1. Okay. So there's like, you know, the moderator, two conservatives and Arnie. And at one point they were talking about something about the minimum wage. And I said on the air, every single state, Republican or Democrat, that has put the minimum wage on the ballot has passed it. Oh, that's not true. I said, really? Fact check me now in real time. Fact check me now in real time. And they kind of looked at me and I said, sorry, I'm not going to get to hear the conversation. I want to prove to you I'm right, you're wrong. So they go to a commercial break. They come back. Did you fact check me? She's right. Okay. But I mean, how many people have the balls to do that? Number one. And number two, I mean, they just didn't think that I would go that far by saying you're lying. But that's ridiculous. That's not how you get news and information, is you have to demand that the institution fact checks themselves, you know, and yet that becomes a problem. So as you're looking at this, is there any hope? Who gets this? Where does the money go? What does Joe Biden talk about in 2024? He wants to embrace democracy. How do you embrace democracy without facts?
Right. No, increasingly we're living in a fact-free media environment. But a lot of that traces back to the collapse of local journalism. And as you were saying, I mean, we do have national news that's still being produced. And whenever we look at cable news, I mean, I should put news in scare quotes, it's mostly just shouting heads right on the screen. Yeah. So we really need to, just in these conversations that we have as a society, we need to understand that just commentary is not the same thing as old-fashioned beat reporting, which is what we're losing, as you said. School boards aren't being covered. State legislatures aren't being covered. City halls aren't being covered. So that's really where we need to go. We know that if people don't get that kinds of news and information, those kinds of news and information, then they're going to go to the so-called pink slime journalism that's just propaganda rushing into the vacuum. So we really need to have these conversations. And you asked if there's any hope. We are seeing slow signs of hope emerging at the state levels. States like New Jersey, California, most recently in Wisconsin, are all looking at ways to subsidize local journalism, but to do so that's democratically determined. It really has to be bottom up, right? We can't just have like some central agency up on high determining who gets the money and who doesn't. It needs to come from the grassroots. And I'm hopeful that we can build a system like that.
Well, for example, in my state, we have something called the New Hampshire Journal, and it's a conservative rag. And he won't really tell us who's paying for it. You know, we have lots of supporters. Yeah, right. You know, and you read it. And because there's such a vacuum, and because they do have this channel of money, and they're incredibly reactionary conservative, they can be at all the events I can't be at. But then they cherry pick what comes out of that event, and that's what they put out. You know, and then because there's no other media source, because nobody else was at that event, you know, you end up having to rely on something that you know intentionally is being distorted. That's the part that just kills me. And I want my audience to realize I started in the New Hampshire legislature in 1984. When I was a young kid, I was like 29 years old or 27 years old, and I'm in the legislature, and you could not get into the newsroom. There were so many reporters there. It was so packed. There was everybody putting out information. It was an incredible space. It was an incredible space. They don't exist anymore. The room is empty. They could turn it into a bathroom. All right. There's no presence there. And I feel it because as someone who covers the news and I try to be a news aggregator, I don't know where to find it. And that's the part that breaks my heart. And I'm going to end this way, Victor, because your piece is just, it's so important, everyone, because we keep talking about democracy, but democracy without information is not democracy. You know, you can't make a choice in a vacuum. You can't. And you can't just trust an Arnie. When I was running for governor, I was running on an income tax. So you know what I used to do? I used to bring the most anti-income tax sophisticated Republican with me to every event because I wanted them to hear both sides. I wanted them to hear the best of both sides and then let them decide. So I was kind of doing my own little media source, but I realized at least I had them physically in a room. But there was nobody that was actually covering to a large extent a lot of what we were talking about the way I could. So as I'm looking at your piece, taking media out of the market isn't the answer to everything. And in the end, it's kind of like healthcare. They're not in the business of healthcare insurance companies. They're in the business of profit. And if you understand that, then when they sell you all this healthcare stuff, the first question you should ask is, and how much money are you making on this opportunity? Because in the end, is it about your health? Do they really care? Or is it about the dollars? And that's the part that makes me a little bit afraid, but I'm hoping that we can begin to look at what is, just before I let you go, Victor, so what is California doing and what are New Jersey doing in order to support some kind of a media response?
Well, they're allocating millions of dollars now towards local journalism. In California, it's up to $25 million. So that's, Even though that sounds like a huge number, that's actually a relative drop in the bucket. But I think first and foremost, as you suggest, they're treating journalism as a public good, not a commodity. Not something whose worth is determined solely by its profitability. And so they're finding ways to guarantee that all members of society have access to a baseline level of news and information. And that really should be our goal. We're not going to be able to do it tomorrow, but we have to keep working towards that horizon.
Victor Picard is the C. Edwin Baker Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs Media Inequality and Change Center. The title of his piece, Taking Media Out of the Market. Thank you so much for doing this, Victor. I really appreciate it.
So good talking to you, Arnie. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-